Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. In early January, an arm of the hacktivist organization Anonymous targeted the young men accused of involvement in the rape of a Steubenville area high school girl last summer. The Anonymous offshoot group, called NightSec, also targeted the school and public officials who have been accused of protecting the alleged perpetrators. And NightSec demanded an apology to the young woman, or else. No apology was forthcoming, so a video of a former Steubenville High School student cruelly joking about the rape was posted on the internet. It went viral, along with more threats from NightSec.
"This docs will be released unless all accused parties come forward by New Year's Day and issue a public apology to the girl and her family. Make no mistake, all you need is a Google search engine to realize we are serious in what we do. You can hide no longer. You have attracted the attention of the hive."
For many, it was the first time they had heard of Anonymous. For many more, however, it was a close brush with a group that has been in their periphery at work, upending websites around the globe. News outlets today are reporting that Anonymous has struck again, this time cracking files from the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank. Last week, Anonymous hacked the website of the U.S. Sentencing Commission. Joining us now is Parmi Olson, the former London bureau chief for Forbes magazine, now stationed in San Francisco. Parmi has written a book on this topic. It's called We Are Anonymous, Inside the Hacker World of LulzSec, Anonymous, and the Global Cyber Insurgency. Welcome to the show, Parmi.
Thank you. It's good to be there.
The whole idea behind or surrounding Anonymous appears to be some element of randomness. From the apparent internet birthplace of the group to the present, how do you define the organization, especially for people who are not necessarily internet savvy?
Yeah, it's very difficult to define it. And when people, as you say, who aren't internet savvy first hear about it, and they listen to that recording that you played just now of this kind of ominous sounding computerized voice and the kind of content, you get the impression it's this single organized group. But it isn't that at all. It's actually much more dissipated, disorganized, and there's no hierarchy. It's really an illustration of how so many modern-day institutions are being constructed now, and which is through crowdsourcing, through viral development. And so Anonymous is really much more of a movement. It's much more of an idea, and many different people can subscribe to it in their own way. And so the people like these splinter groups that you mentioned, NightSec, mm-hmm. And even those who carry out cyber attacks in the name of Anonymous, they don't even give themselves a separate name. They really are just small groups who are kind of working together, perhaps half a dozen, less or more, and carrying out various attacks or pranks sometimes, and invoking the name Anonymous because that has such a reputation now in the media. And because they're anonymous, nobody can sort of prove one way or the other if they really are hackers or if they're not. So they can kind of cloak themselves in the notoriety of that name and get a lot of attention. And as far as what they do with that name, there is some coherence there. It's typically either protest, so activism or hacktivism, as it's being called now, hackers who are activists, vigilantism, as we've seen in this particular case that you cited, and pranks, just hacking a big corporation for fun because they can, because they found a vulnerability in the website and they can steal lots of data from it, is a big reason why a lot of elements of this movement will actually act.
If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Parmi Olson. She's a senior writer for Forbes and the author of We Are Anonymous. If you have a question or comment for Parmi about the Anonymous organization or lack thereof, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page. You can tweet us at WOSU All Sides. Lots of choice. Parmi, you've said that Anonymous does matter, just not in the way that we think. What's the distinction there?
Well, I think in the way that we think of Anonymous, or the way that the mainstream public will see Anonymous, there's a sense of fear there that this is a group that is threatening our data and is threatening the stability of websites and the internet itself. There was even a threat, I think, about a year ago for Anonymous to shut down the entire internet or to shut down Facebook.
Right.
You know, and there's these very grand threats that are made, and a lot of people actually, because they don't know how this stuff works, kind of take it seriously, and they get a little bit nervous about that. And this is really what Anonymous does best, is exploit this fear, particularly a generational fear about technology. In all the interviews that I did of Anonymous, of people in Anonymous, I found there were many different types of people, men, women, but most of them were relatively young, under 30. And so they'd kind of grown up with the internet and they understood technology very well. People who are older than that perhaps aren't as familiar with the internet, and so there comes a little bit of fear of invasions of privacy and of the stability of their online property and of what these guys are actually able to do. But by and large, the threats that these guys are making a lot of the time aren't kind of worth the paper they're written on. It's a lot of fluff a lot of the time. They're very effective at creating a lot of hype and getting a lot of attention around the threats that they're making.
But they have been, or some of them have been, arrested for something. 16 were suspected members of Anonymous were arrested in the summer of 2011.
Right.
There were, among those were the three, I think among those were the three members that you focused on in the book, Topiary, Sabu, and Kayla.
Yes. Yes, that's right. There's been a real, quite a string of arrests just in the last year. And the group that I profiled was called LulzSec. So they were a splinter group. You mentioned NightSec before. They have the name SEC at the end because that's short for security. So Lulz for LulzSec is basically a derivation of LOL, which means laugh out loud. But Lulz means having fun at someone else's expense. So it was like an anti-security kind of free-for-all that these guys were doing. And there's only about six of them in this group. But when they were at large, when they were carrying out these attacks, nobody really knew how many were in there. They knew there was some association with Anonymous. Maybe it was 100 people. Maybe it was more. And it really was just these six guys kind of in various places around the world talking together online, up at all hours, and kind of scheming over the course of about 50 days who they could attack next. And they were just kind of getting so much press attention and just kind of riding on the thrill and euphoria of that experience of hitting Sony Pictures or PBS, NewsHour's website, and it was just a wild ride for them. And then, of course, they ended up getting caught by the police because it's much as you may think, a lot of these hackers think they can get away with it, they can remain anonymous. There's always, always a way to track them, and there's always going to be somebody who will turn them in, who will act as an informant, and which is exactly what happened with LulzSec. The leader of the group actually ended up being an informant for the FBI and basically snitched on everyone else in the group, which kind of helped lead to their arrests. And, you know, these guys are facing who knows what kind of sentences. They have committed crimes under the law, cyber crimes. They've stolen data, and these companies have come forward and calculated how much damage was actually caused on their servers, and it goes into the millions in some cases. And so, you know, there have been a couple of sentencings already in the UK. One guy was sentenced to something like 18 months in jail. Another guy was sentenced to 7 months. But these are, it's still very early days,
right,
in terms of these kinds of crimes, particularly for this type of group of people, you know, setting a legal precedent for what kind of sentences they should get. And I think a lot of the lawyers for these guys are kind of looking around nervously and watching what's happening to see how they can argue their cases and what they can argue for, what kind of plea bargains they can make, because this is all so very new.
Have they, when they busted into these webs, or in, you know, when they hacked these places, did they profit at all from any of this?
That's a good question. And as far as I understand from most everyone that I've spoken to, for the most part, no, they didn't. And they didn't do it for money.
Mm-hmm.
They did it for notoriety, by and large. And they did it for fun. So it's kind of when they do one hack and they get a lot of attention for it, not just from the press, but from the online community that they're part of, they're part of this community that mostly communicates through chat networks. So they'll be in a chat room with maybe 100 people, maybe 200 people, and everyone in that room will be kind of talking about the event and mentioning their name. And when they're in that chat room, they kind of feel this sense of accomplishment and fulfillment. And then they're in their private chat room with the group and kind of saying, oh, this is what everybody's saying about us. And look what the New York Times said about us. And we're on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it's a great feeling for them. But, you know, it all leads to eventually it leads to problems.
I imagine that in 10 years, they'll all be high paid consultants.
Yeah, I mean, who knows, really? This is what's happened in the past.
Exactly.
Kevin Mitnick was one of the most notorious hackers out there, and now he's, you know, he does speaking engagements, and he's got a book, or I think he's got two books. Kevin Paulson is another kind of notorious hacker.
Okay, it looks like we lost Parmi Olson. We'll go to a break right now and work on that. So stay with us. We'll be right back with Parmi Olson, author of We Are Anonymous. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News team.
While the job market both regionally and statewide has shown signs of recovery during the past year, Miami University economist John Boblis says middle-class jobs have been slow to return.
So you're sort of getting this dichotomy going on of people with high skills getting paid high wages and people who don't have those skills can't find...
Hear the latest in local and national news on Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
This is 89.7 NPR News. And your annual support is our largest source of income. Your gifts make up the funds we use to pay for the news you listen to every day. It's easy to renew your membership. Just visit us online at WOSU.org/renew. Call 1-866-897-9678. Or respond to our mailing by sending a generous check. Your annual gift provides us with the foundation of listener support. Thank you for renewing your membership with 89.7 NPR News. And it's 33 degrees in downtown Columbus. Clouds today warming up to a high of 42. Some rain moving in overnight tonight, a low of 33 degrees. And then rain mixing with a little snow Friday morning. Temperatures falling to around 28 degrees. Partly cloudy Friday night, a low of 21. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Parmi Olson. She's a senior writer for Forbes and the author of a book. It's called We Are Anonymous, Inside the Hacker World of Lulzsec Anonymous and the Global Cyber Insurgency. If you have a question or comment for Parmi, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Parmi, how did you manage to track down these sources for the book? How did you know who they were? And I suppose, furthermore, how do they know who each other is?
Yeah, that's a good question. For me to actually track them down, it was just a matter of hearing about it on the internet, reading an article, and thinking this is a really, really interesting group or organization. I'd love to learn more. And then I'd heard that, I think I'd read an article where one particular man in the United States in Boston, his name is Greg Hausch, was a, kind of a spokesman for Anonymous, but he called himself an observer of the group. And I was able to get hold of him and said, look, can you put me in touch with the UK representative? Because I was in London at the time. He gave me an email address that was kind of, didn't have a name attached to it, but was kind of anonops@gmail.com. And this was kind of a generic email address being shared by various people. And I sent a bunch of questions to that email address, and the person who responded was just providing lots of very articulate answers about what Anonymous was trying to do and how they worked. And we just kept the conversation going. And I wanted to know more about the person behind the email address, and it turned out that that person was Topiary, which ended up being the kind of main person that drove the book when I started writing it several months later. So it was kind of just started from there, and asking Topiary to introduce me to other people in the network. And then I also had a lot of people just come to me through Facebook. They would send me direct messages or approach me in the chat rooms and just kind of offer to share their stories. And that's how I kind of managed to speak to some of these people. It's kind of, it seems at first like a lot of them don't want to talk, but once they see that you have an interest in who they are and what they're doing, a lot of them are actually very willing to share. As for how they communicate with each other, you know, when I first started writing about Anonymous, I thought, well, they must kind of meet up in pubs or something, or get together and have a drink and have meetings. But after I spoke to Topiary for the first time, he explained that no, they never meet, they never talk on the phone, nobody knows the other person's name. All the meetings take place online, so there's communication via Twitter and internet relay chat networks, IRC networks, so chat rooms, primarily where you're part of a network and you can be in one of dozens of chat rooms to talk to people with all sorts of different nicknames.
And so when you were talking to them, the individuals, did you talk to them in person? And did, when you were talking to them about the other people, did they know who you were talking about? Or was it all in code name? Was it all Topiary? And
yeah, I mean, you're kind of getting to the point where it is actually, it does get confusing because people in the group will change names. So there's like this push and pull between wanting notoriety and wanting to keep the same name, so that say you do a hack and you're using the name Topiary, just hypothetically, you would want to come back into the chat room as that same name because you're getting so much credit for it and attention, and you know, everyone's praising you for it. But actually the wiser thing to do if you wanted to avoid arrest is not to use the same name, because then a year later when the police are going through all these chat logs that some informant has actually been saving, they can see that same name coming up over and over again and kind of bragging about the different things that they've done. So there's this real kind of, it's for a lot of these guys difficult to reconcile that desire for notoriety and the kind of being reasonable and not using the same name all the time. And it does get confusing because some people will go through three or four different names. But once you're in the community for long periods of time, and a lot of these guys are online for long periods of time, they start to remember, oh, this person uses this name and this name and this name. They remember all the different names attached to one person, and they just keep track of it.
You begin the book on Super Bowl Sunday in 2011 with the story of a digital security executive named Aaron Barr and his downfall with Anonymous. What was his sin and what did they do to him?
Well, what Aaron Barr was trying to do was find out who the leaders of Anonymous were. He was working for, he was the CEO of a small cybersecurity company that had contracts with the government, based in Washington, D.C., in the Washington, D.C. area. And he wanted to kind of basically drum up some, promote his company and drum up some interest in his company. So he thought one way to do that was, well, hey, let me try and investigate Anonymous, see what I can find out, and I'll present my findings at a forthcoming conference. And right before the conference, when he'd started gathering this information by going into chat rooms and under various pseudonyms, trying to talk to people in the chat rooms and gather information on them and try and piece together who they were and who was important. You know, he gave an interview to the Financial Times and said, this is the work that I'm doing, and I'm going to be presenting it at this conference. And then a few hackers, kind of quite skilled programmers who are part of Anonymous, read that article. They decided, well, look, we can't let this guy get away with it. And so they kind of teamed together. This was about six or seven of them, and basically broke into his email, stole all his corporate emails. And one reason they were able to do that was because the password that he'd chosen for his email account and for his web application for his website was very easy to crack. It was very short, And he'd use the same password for all sorts of different web accounts, which is a big no-no. Most people
it's like the number one no-no.
Yeah, but he was a cybersecurity businessman, so it was kind of ironic that he'd done that. But anyway, so they were able to crack his Twitter account and his Facebook account and his LinkedIn and just all sorts of different things, his World of Warcraft account. And then they took all his emails and posted them online for anybody to see. It just caused a huge kind of media storm. And as an aside, the guys who had performed that cyber attack ended up becoming the founders of LulzSec, that hacker splinter group, which kind of ran rampant through the summer of 2011.
And that is sort of like the prankster arm of it, the one that just likes to make fun of people, and have fun at other people's expense.
Exactly. Like I was saying earlier on in the segment, there's different motivations running for people in Anonymous. And for some, it's to be pranksters, to kind of cause havoc for the sake of causing havoc. And for others, there's a real kind of genuine sense they want to promote change. They want to call out an individual or an institution that they feel is corrupt. And sometimes those two motivations can go hand in hand. So, a hacker might feel, or a supporter of Anonymous might feel, that one particular target deserves to be attacked and deserves to be shown up. And in the process of attacking them, they're going to have a lot of fun doing it. And so with the attack on Aaron Barr, it really spun out of control because he was such an easy target. With the, it was so easy to crack his password. It had been used several times. That the amount, the way that they kind of showed him up and attacked him was just quite bad and quite extreme.
The internet site that spawned the group, 4chan.net, included lots of discussion boards that were pretty rank. Lots of porn, abuse, racist references, and so forth. What's the underpinnings of all that? What is that community out there doing that for?
That's kind of a difficult question to answer. This is 4chan is really like the foundation of Anonymous. This is a website that Anonymous kind of came from. Mm-hmm. The reason why they're called Anonymous, this movement, is because on 4chan, you cannot post a comment with a name. You're forced to be anonymous. So, when people post comments on a website, they'll have a nickname and they'll be asked to put a name. You can't do that. It's everybody who posts in a discussion is anonymous. And, this is a website that started back in 2004, and they implemented the forced anonymity about a year later. And it really just got very popular after that. It was a place to discuss anything and everything, very popular with young men. And I think also that the forced anonymity kind of created this interesting dynamic in discussions. People could kind of feel they could say whatever they wanted without any fear of retribution. They could confess to any of their strange proclivities or emotional kind of flaws that they might have. And for some people, it was actually like a safe community to come to and confess all these kinds of things or say whatever they wanted. But of course, the other consequence to that is there's a lot of just, it's kind of like the id of the internet. It's been described in that way, where people just kind of say whatever they want, and it can end up being quite unscrupulous when you actually look at what that is.
At the outset, was it all just pranks, or was there any moral code for Anonymous's actions? I know it's broken up into these factions now, but did it start off surely as pranksterism?
I think you could say that. But also, like I was saying before, the desire for pranks can go hand in hand with the desire for vigilantism and the desire to show up someone who deserves to be punished. And so some of the early targets were, for instance, there was a radio DJ who was kind of known for making the occasional offensive remark or racist remark. And so members of 4chan would go and spam that person's website and take it offline. And then it kind of really came to a head in 2008 when we had the kind of attacks against Scientology. And that was spurred by a video of Tom Cruise that had been leaked on YouTube It was kind of an internally made Scientology video where he talked about being part of the religion. And Scientology tried to, the church tried to take it down from YouTube. And members of Anonymous were just, supporters of Anonymous were so incensed by that. And when I say supporters of Anonymous, a lot of these discussions were taking place on 4chan. People on the website were kind of saying, they started a discussion board and said, we've got to stand up against Scientology. We can't tolerate this any longer. Let's show them what we can do. And so they just kind of came together, and or they kind of encouraged each other to download a very simple web tool that allowed them to spam the main Scientology website and take it offline for a long period of time. It was actually a very simple thing to do, but the power really came in numbers. If you could get enough people to do this, we're talking maybe a couple hundred people, they could effectively take down this website.
Eric in Canal Winchester, you're on the air with Parmi Olson of Forbes. Welcome.
Hi. As a, I guess, a longtime 4chan user, I'm familiar with it, and I think the main reason that you see so much just disgusting stuff on there is simply because it's all anonymous and people can get away with it, and it creates this culture where people just kind of thrive on that. And I'm not really a fan of that, but I wanted to say that the idea that Anonymous is just a few select people, or I mean, it has its cores, but it almost operates as a terrorist organization, to the point of it has cells, and really anyone who has a keyboard and a somewhat okay computer can act as a member of Anonymous.
And it's actually, that's a great point. When I first started writing about Anonymous, I asked someone who was kind of an expert in group psychology and different types of groups and how they work and organize themselves, what kind of group he could best compare Anonymous to. And he said, the closest thing that I can think of is Al-Qaeda. And I was really struck by that. Like, oh my goodness, that's such a kind of extreme comparison to make. But actually, he meant in terms of how they organize themselves, the fact that we have this sense, the public has this sense that Al-Qaeda is this group with a hierarchy, and it's very well organized, and it's extremely threatening. But it's actually very disorganized. There's a lot of paranoia within the network, and it's very nodal. There's lots of different nodes, little groups that work within it and don't talk to each other, and some of them do talk to each other. And that's exactly what it's like with Anonymous. So when the police manage to arrest members of one particular hacking group and kind of say, well, we've cut off the head of the snake now, they actually haven't. It's like cutting off the arm of a starfish. It's another arm is going to eventually grow back. So it's why it's very difficult for the authorities, prosecutors, the police, to wrap their heads around something like that, because this is a really kind of new type of way of organizing themselves. This is a kind of internet-based institution.
Eric, thanks a lot for your call. Take care. So the activity that occurred regarding the Steubenville rape case suggested that at least one faction of it does have a really strong moral code. They thought this was very wrong, what was happening, and they made these threats. Is that typically what happens, is they threaten first, and if whoever they're threatening doesn't pony up with an apology or with some kind of acknowledgement, then they go forward?
I haven't seen the kind of pattern in how these groups carry out those kinds of attacks. In the ones that I was observing at very close at hand, they wouldn't make a threat. They would just basically look for a vulnerability in a particular target they were interested in, or just cast out a kind of virtual net and look for holes or security holes in any high-profile website. And then if that website was of interest to them, then they would go after it. And then they would take that target by surprise. It wasn't a matter of threatening them, because I think, if you threaten a high-profile website like that belongs to a corporation, then they'll get their IT security guys on board, they'll get a cybersecurity consultant on board, and they'll try to stop you from actually carrying out an attack. So just from the attacks that I was observing, a lot of them were using the element of surprise. But I suppose when it comes to this case, they're also trying to get a message out, mm-hmm. as opposed to just trying to disrupt for the sake of disrupting. And so making that threat ahead of time, perhaps even if they don't carry out a hack successfully, at least they've got some attention and they've called out this person, because the name of Anonymous tends to get a lot of attention when it's invoked.
Exactly. I mean, the group that invoked it in the Steubenville case could have been from Steubenville, for all we know, right?
Right. Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And it got international attention because it associated with Anonymous.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the same thing happens all the time. It kind of amazes me that anyone can use the name Anonymous and still manage to get a fair amount of press attention if they choose a topic that's very timely, has a lot of people interested in the news. And a really great example was in 2011, some guy, I think he was an ex-employee of Bank of America, claimed that Anonymous had lots of emails, had managed to obtain emails from Bank of America. And it kind of affected Bank of America's share price, and lots of newspapers were writing about it. And this guy was saying Anonymous is going to drop all the information on Monday. And then, of course, when Monday came along, it was basically just an email exchange between himself and another employee at Bank of America discussing kind of their grievances with management and kind of minor problems at the bank. And it was really nothing. It was the sack of potatoes. But it got so much attention because it was just at the time when WikiLeaks had said that it was going to go after a big corporation. Anonymous was already hacking other institutions. So if you do it at the right time, you can cause a lot of hype in just a matter of hours.
Some recent activity from Anonymous in the reference to Operation Last Resort concerned the suicide death of Aaron Swartz. He's the famous internet developer and activist who started the website Reddit. He was indicted by the Justice Department in July 2011, it so happens, on charges of wire fraud and computer fraud, unlawfully obtaining information from a protected computer and recklessly damaging a protected computer. And as well, the WikiLeaks connection, they're out there asserting vengeance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's very hard to pin down who these guys are and why they're doing it. I mean, in the case of Aaron Swartz, it's a real tragedy what happened with him. And I think that story kind of really epitomizes the difficulties for, you know, these are a lot of these guys are young men who spend a lot of time on their computers. This is their world. This is where they feel comfortable. They have a community online. And one thing that I think is really important to remember, particularly for the guys who get arrested for doing this, and I've spoken to some of them who've been arrested and who kind of been on tag now for a year or more. And one thing that one of them was saying to me was that it's just so easy to commit a crime, to do something that's going to implicate yourself. Because when you're in a chat room, everything's moving so quickly. You'll have 10 different chat rooms open, quick conversation. You think something and you type it and it's just there forever if someone's logging it. And you only have to say a few things to implicate yourself. And, you know, a few months down the line, prosecutors could have some kind of evidence against you. And also, you know, another thing that Anonymous really exemplifies is just how easy it is now to hack a website. It's possible to download a very simple web tool that can automate a cyber attack for you. And I was speaking to a cybersecurity executive not long ago, and he was telling me that he taught his 15-year-old son how to use one of these software tools, and he'd learned it in about a quarter of an hour, how to do it. And it really is very simple to carry out these kinds of attacks. And, you know, in these kinds of networks, these chat networks, they're all kind of giving tips to each other about what software to use, what website to use, how to hack. And that's another thing that Anonymous ends up acting as, is not only a meeting ground, but a kind of schoolyard, almost like a school of hard knocks, for learning how to get to the next level of hacking. And it's really not that difficult. Once you learn a few basic things, it's pretty straightforward.
Sounds kind of like recipe for the A-bomb or something. My guest is Parmi Olson. She's a senior writer for Forbes. We're talking about her book, We Are Anonymous. Coming up, we're going to add to the conversation cybersecurity expert. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. On the next Fresh Air, Bradley Cooper talks about his Oscar-nominated performance in Silver Linings Playbook and lots of other things, including the really dark adult movies he grew up watching with his father, why he wanted to be a soldier when he was young, how he sometimes cries like a hyena, and why he hates it when photographers ask him to do those sexy man poses. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins later today at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides begins with a discussion of the intelligence and genius of dogs. Stay with us for All Sides from 11 till noon. Cloudy skies today and a high of 42. Rain tonight, a low of 33 degrees. A rain-snow mix with temperatures falling to about 28 degrees on Friday. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. Still with us, Parmi Olson, senior writer for Forbes and author of We Are Anonymous. Joining us now, Chiranjeev Bordoloi. He is CEO of TopPatch. He's consulted for government agencies, financial institutions, and Fortune 500 companies on cybersecurity for more than two decades. Chiranjeev, we just kind of wrapped up the conversation on the last segment talking about how this website is sort of an incubator for hacking. And I wondered, is there ever an end to this? Is this something like as soon as you create one wall, they'll just figure out a way to get over it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think an easier analogy to understand what's going on here is where the police came up with great radar detectors, and the manufacturers of Fuzzbusters just came out with better devices, right? And so it's like a cat and mouse game. And the same thing for cybersecurity. You'll find that as cybersecurity professionals come up with more defensive strategies, you'll see offensive strategies change and evolve and become better. So, a good example is, antivirus and firewall used to be good enough, just a few years ago. But then, the New York Times writes a front page article about how antivirus isn't enough, right? So it's that evolution of technology as it continues to happen. Tools will get more sophisticated on both sides.
I guess it's sort of full employment for you, but does anything ever really super damaging happen, or is it just embarrassing at this point?
I think back in the day when, it was more of a sport, right? The goal was to bring down a network.
To see if you could do it.
Bring down. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So downtime was the goal, right? So, and even today, I think as signs of protest, as a socio-political agenda, I think bringing a website down is part of, part of the attack vector, if you will. But over time, I think attacks, the people who really mean to, who are in this business for criminal reasons, they have one goal, right, which is to achieve financial gain. So I think attacks will become less and less apparent, so similar to how, you just read all over the news, how the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal had been hacked. They just didn't know for months, right? Same thing for these natural gas pipelines and so on and so forth. So you will never know whether or not you've been hacked, but odds are you have, right? And it's just a matter of whether or not they have what's called root access, complete control over your computer and the ability to plant programs that do specific things, right? So You know, so I think the tax will become less and less apparent, and consumers will feel it less and less. But in terms of downtime, but in terms of actual impact, you know, it's watching their credit cards on sale in some chat room, the frequency of that will go up dramatically.
Parmi Olsen, these guys that you interviewed behind at least the core of Anonymous, are they the kinds of personalities that are just going to grow up and grow out of this, or do you see them growing up and making more of it?
I think the guys who I spoke to will definitely grow out of it, particularly once they get arrested and they see that there is a real kind of the harsh light of the courtroom just makes them realize this was actually a bad idea. And so they kind of have to reinvent themselves, perhaps go into consulting or something like that. I don't know. But there's always going to be someone who replaces them. And it'll probably be more than one person who replaces them because the internet is becoming so prevalent now. I mean, gosh, just look at emerging markets. How many more people are getting online now? Not because of the prevalence of the internet itself or computers, but smartphones. There's so many more smartphones being bought in places like China and Brazil. And over the next few years, we're going to see so many more people coming online just through their smartphones. Now, I'm not saying that means we're going to have a larger movement or expanding or swelling of the movement like Anonymous, but who knows what's going to change in that kind of dynamic as so many more people come online. And just remember that particularly for young people who are growing up in isolated environments, if they come from difficult families or they're in a very isolated part of the country, which was the case with the people I was interviewing by and large, a lot of them find the internet a very attractive place to hang out, and they find a lot of people that they can have a lot of share a lot in common with, and that's always going to be attractive to the next generation and the generation after that, so long as the internet is there and those kinds of communities are there.
Chris in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Chris.
Hi.
Hi.
I've only heard one BBC article mention the fact that the target systems are almost entirely Microscum software from Bill Gates. The defects in Windows that allows many of these things to happen. There are even websites called Zero Day, meaning day zero when an exploit is discovered. These people are already have been aware of it and are prepared to use it.
So the point
is that there should be considered alternatives like Macintosh, like Linux, like formerly Sun, now Oracle's Solaris. The operating system for Microscum is scummy.
Chiranjeev Bordoloi, what's your sense about that?
I actually couldn't hear the question very well at all.
Okay, he was saying that a lot of the problem is the Microsoft operating system is what's permitting so much of this hacking.
So it's not just Microsoft. To be honest, there is Microsoft's gotten a lot better over the years in terms of understanding that they are the target of a lot of these attacks, and therefore, they've improved their defensive mechanisms significantly, right? But we see attacks when we go into companies and we try to secure their networks and their applications and their operating systems. We see, many different flavors of Linux running there. We see, Windows. We see even OS X, right? Even Macs are not, immune to these types of attacks. But it's not just the operating system per se, right? It's also the applications that run on these operating systems. Now, the gentleman who asked the question is right in that what happens is that attackers exploit the vulnerabilities in these operating systems that have not been patched. And it's no different from you knowing that, the latch on your back door is weak and a simple tug opens the door, but you not doing anything about it just because you haven't had the time, because you've been busy doing other things and so on and so forth. So and if an intruder wants to enter your home, they just go tug on the back door and they're in. It's the same. It's the exact same thing for computers.
Thanks, Chris, for that call. Parmi Olsen, you wrote about how Anonymous members perfected the process of social engineering, and I thought that was very interesting, but it was sort of just like cyber con men.
Yeah, that's a big part of their effectiveness. And one of the things that I've been trying to get across in my book and generally is the point that we really fear anonymous because of their ability to hack and the threats that they make about stealing data. But as Sanjeev was saying earlier, you know, the scary ones are the ones you never hear about. They're the ones who are probably, you know, already hacking someone and that target doesn't even know that they're being hacked. Whereas anonymous is really different. They are hacking so that they can get attention for a cause or for themselves or to have fun. And so, you know, if they're the ones who will be making a lot of noise, but perhaps not causing that much damage. And that's what they're really good at doing. They're really good at getting attention to themselves. And also, you know, their methods of stealing data are kind of very modern day methods of social engineering. It's not necessarily hacking something, but asking nicely or posing as a 16-year-old girl when you're actually kind of a 27-year-old man. Posing as a different gender or as a young girl online is very, a very common social engineering tactic to try and take data from someone.
Chirandeev, do you try to, or do your colleagues or people who do what you do, do you monitor things like 4chan.net? 4chan.net?
Yeah, we do. And security researchers, you know, we actually dedicate people to conduct security research and monitor the threat landscape. What I do see happening in the future, right, is where, you know, let me use this, you know, analogy that perhaps listeners can understand easier, is, you know, if you're going to go rob a bank, right, you want to create a diversion elsewhere so the police are now going towards that diversion so that you can rob the bank with lower risk. So I see what, you know, happening in the future is I see people actually using anonymous's notoriety, if you will, and leveraging that to create diversions in while a greater and more sophisticated attack for financial gain is being conducted elsewhere. So they will use the anonymous label for a sociopolitical attack, but in order, because, you know, listen, cybersecurity professionals are just like cops, right? I mean, they're just a few of us, and we're overworked. They're just, you know, there isn't enough you can, you know, go solve. So the reality is, so when there is a diversion, you know, and executives are like, oh, my bank website's going to go down, everyone's sucked into that. What might really be going on is that they're going after your wire transfer system or your ACH system or some other financial transaction system, right? Or they may be placing trades, you know, manipulating the stock market, doing something that's a lot more severe and monetarily rewarding than actually just bringing down a website. But bringing down the website draws all the attention, you know? So you know, I see that happening in the future.
We have an email from Ben. He writes, do your guests have any comment on the recent Department of Justice hack by Anonymous? Do they feel that the recent leaks from the Department of Justice, for example, the terrorist kill memo and the drone location in Saudi Arabia, are linked to Anonymous's hack of the Department of Justice? Parmi Olson, any thoughts on that?
To be honest, I haven't been covering that particular story. I'm not really on the Anonymous beat full time as I was before, but it's kind of, I'm pretty sure they've hacked the, or claimed to have hacked the Department of Justice in the past. So, you know, again, it would probably be a cell of individuals who were working together. Perhaps there was an element of retribution there, but to be honest, I can't really answer one way or the other.
Chirandeev, what about you?
Yeah, me neither. You know, the thing, if it's done well, you can only react and respond. You can't really, you know, it's difficult to kind of pinpoint, you know, do the forensics aspect of it. Was it anonymous? Was it not? You know, was it actually someone else with, you know, using an anonymous signature? So a lot of that ends up being speculation and very expensive speculation at that. So I definitely, you know, I can't really comment with any accuracy as well. Yeah.
Pardon me, do you mention that there's not enough of you out there? If this is such a big deal and if all my, you know, pretty much my assets and everything are tied up with organizations that could be hacked, where's the imperative here to do more?
Well, Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And frankly, to be fair to business, the portion of budgets being allocated to security, the portion of IT budgets being allocated to security is going up steadily. Okay, so, you know, people are kind of dedicating resources, if you will. But now, when you're dealing with organized crime migrating to these attacks, you know, so you've got a bunch of guys who just no longer, they don't deal drugs anymore. They've got sophisticated data centers with, you know, T1 lines going out the door with, you know, GPU computing in there to crack passwords. You know, it's far more rewarding, and you're up against a formidable enemy, right? So I think the whole public-private partnerships aspect that's going on in the world, in the security world, is going to be very valuable, where, you know, the government is working with private companies to figure out, to learn best practices and share best practice from each other. I think, you know, a lot of these kids, these smart kids who get involved in hacking with a sociopolitical agenda, I mean, you can call it anonymous or whatever else, will, you know, realize that it's, you know, you can go earn a $150,000 a year salary by actually joining the good side, you know, by being a good guy. So, you know, it just becomes, I think the economics will work themselves out. I think, over time, you know, the tools will get more sophisticated on the defense side of things. So it's just like anything else, like any other problem, right? It's like any other disease, if you will. You know, there is a, you know, spectacular set of diseases out there, but so is there, you know, an evolution in the healing mechanisms for those diseases.
Parmi Olson, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you, I know you're not following Anonymous full-time, as you just said, but are there other groups out there that we don't really, the rest of us don't know about yet that are gaining steam like Anonymous or not?
I think there probably is, and it's really just a matter of them popping out of nowhere. And that's kind of what happened with Anonymous. You know, they come from way back in 2004, 2005. That was the beginnings of this movement. But it wasn't until 2008 that they kind of came out and attacked Scientology just out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And then they kind of went into hibernation for something like 2 years. And, you know, there were small cells doing things here and there, getting a little bit of attention. But then mm-hmm. it really just reared its head again out of nowhere in December 2010. And so with WikiLeaks and the attacks on MasterCard, Visa, and PayPal, mm-hmm. and then LulzSec came along. So now we're kind of at this kind of lull again. There have been quite a few attacks here and there, but nothing particularly huge. And I think as we're talking earlier about evolution of defense systems, that can happen, but I think these hackers will always be around, and who knows when they'll pop up again as something big and very much more effective.
Parmi Olson, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Parmi Olson, senior writer for Forbes and also the author of We Are Anonymous, and Chiranjeev Bordoloi, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Chiranjeev is CEO of Top Patch. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.